Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Nicholas Evans, author of the sweeping The Divide, published by Putnam. In the weeks to come, we have Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Walter Kern, Nicholas Sparks, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It is my pleasure to welcome one of our favorite authors, Nicholas Evans, once again to the Tattered Cover. Mr. Evans was born and educated in England, launched a career as a journalist, and then moved to television and film. He was encouraged by David Lean, whom he met while doing a film about the famed director, to turn from making documentaries about people in the arts to making fiction, so to speak. And then in 1993, he had an encounter that was to change his life. From a blacksmith, he heard about horse whispers, those with an almost magical ability to heal traumatized horses, and the rest, as they say, is history. His first novel, The Horse Whisperer, was published in 1995 and became an international bestseller and has been translated into 36 languages. This great success was followed by other best-selling novels, The Loop and The Smoke Jumper. Well, how this Englishman came to use the American West, specifically the state of Montana, as a setting for his novels can be attributed to his love of Westerns when he was a boy. And then, when he saw Montana, he knew he had found the landscape and people he wanted to write about. True to form, the new book we celebrate this evening, The Divide, is set there, and begins when the frozen body of a young woman is found in a stream bed. This young woman, Abby Cooper, is the daughter of an affluent family who summered at a dude ranch in Montana called The Divide. They were a family that seemed to have everything, but then things fell apart as the parents divorced, and Abby became involved in acts of eco-terrorism that led to her being wanted for murder, but now she herself is a victim. Sheriff Charlie Riggs sets out to find the circumstances of her death, while her family must find a way to heal not only their sorrow, but also their relationships with each other. As we all know, Mr. Evans is a masterful storyteller. Sorry. Wrong Nicholas. I knew I'd do that. And has once again treated us to a compelling exploration of human relationships and the fragile landscape he so beautifully uses as a setting. Please join me in welcoming Nicholas Evans.
Thank you, Margaret, very much. The high point of this tour is always Denver. I just so love coming to this. This is, to my mind, the greatest bookstore in the world, and the ones I've seen, anyway. And it makes all of those sort of sitting in Costco's that authors now have to do, sit in these windy kind of lobbies with a huge stack of books, but very few people kind of coming past. This makes it all kind of worthwhile. So thank you for braving the snow tonight and coming. Around this time, Margaret's done my work for me in a way, but around this time in a talk, some of you may have heard me speak before, but a lot of people think that I'm American, and that really pleases me because the voice in my head and the voice in the books is American, and not at all the voice that comes out of my mouth. In fact, when people want me to read, I generally don't. I'm going to read you something tonight, but not from the book, because you can read that if you'd like to anyway at home. this love affair with America started very young, as Margaret said. I loved Westerns. I was an Indian for the first 10 years of my life. My poor sister got to be the cowboy. And I didn't get to come to the States until I was about 19 years old. And I came with a production of Hamlet. We put on a production of Hamlet at college. And managed to persuade some very gullible East Coast colleges to not just let us stage it there, but to pay for our entire trip. It was fantastic. I could tell you, and in fact I probably should have told you, that I played Hamlet. You wouldn't be any the wiser if I pretended that, but in fact I didn't. I played a character called Ronaldo, which you could be forgiven for not knowing figures in the plot. But he's a very pivotal figure. He has three lines, the first of which is, "I will, my lord." Then it's, "My lord, I will." And then he says, "'Tis done, my lord." And I never once blew my lines in the entire trip. I did what kids of that age, of sort of student age, did and used to do in those days, which was in their summer vacations, which was to greyhound across America. Nowadays, kids all head off to Thailand and dance on the beaches by the full moon and smoke a lot of pot. But in those days, we used to. The exciting thing was to greyhound across America. For $100, you could go anywhere. There was probably a time limit on it, but that's what you were able to do. I'm not saying that no pot was smoked, but it's certainly not by me, of course. But it was that it was then that I got to discover America, and discovered, as I did later when I worked as a journalist here for a British TV TV station, a current affairs show. I covered American politics for a British TV weekly current affairs show. I got to discover that America was not, as many people think, in Britain, the coasts, you know, New York, LA, and maybe nowadays Disney World and Miami. But 100 different and wonderfully different countries in between those places. Little towns in the Midwest just were a complete eye-opener for me, the way in which certain kinds of values, and in the West too, certain kinds of values which had long since gone in England still lived there, and still live there today too. These places are real communities, in my view, to be treasured. Stories for writers happen, at least stories that can amount to novels, an idea that's big enough for a novel, happen in different ways. And for me, looking back on this rather measly four novels that I've written, my publishers wish I could write faster, but I just seem to pour so much of myself into these books that it takes me a while to fill up. In fact, my wife tells me you just have to find a new way each time to be unhappy, which it is not true. I have to tell you, it's not true. But I looking back on these four books, they each happened with a kind of collision of ideas. I've always been the sort of person who squirrels away ideas. I will rip a piece out of a newspaper or a magazine, and my family will pick up a magazine and know I've been at it by this great hole that's ripped in the page there. And I tuck them away in files and write notes, particularly as I get older. Any idea that wanders across my aging brain, I have to write down in a notebook, otherwise it'll be gone forever. And quite often these wouldn't amount to a quarter, maybe even a 16th of an idea for a novel, but sometimes things collide. As it was that way with The Horse Whisperer, because of my great love of the West, and I'd always I'd intended for some time as a screenwriter and a producer of movies to one day write a Western, a love story set in the contemporary American West. And then I met this guy on Dartmoor, very near to where I now live in Devon in the southwest of England, who mentioned these two words, Horse Whisperer, which changed my life. And I realized pretty soon that I had this, after when I started to research it and become more and more obsessed with it, that I had the key character for a novel. So there was that collision of two different things. In the next book, The Loop, when I was researching The Horse Whisperer, I happened to meet, I'd gone to see this woman about a horse, and her husband was the man who was intimately involved in the recovery of the gray wolf in Montana, and told me all about the terrible animosity and uproar it was causing, the even violence between the ranchers and the environmentalists in that part of the world. With The Smoke Jumper, it was the same, and with The Divide, it wasn't so much a collision of two or more ideas, it was a catastrophic freefall into it. I love to ski the backcountry, and I was in France a couple of years ago, and I'd had my eye on this fantastic slope. It was the time of year, it was early spring, but the snow was it was clear, hot days, and a lot of snow, and it was melting during the day and then freezing hard at night. So the next morning when the sun hits the snow, I'm talking in Denver here, so a lot of people will know this kind of, it's a little short of ecstasy. You get this little inch or half inch of perfect skiable snow on a hard base the next morning when the sun hits it. And I like to ski, as I say, the backcountry, and so it's skins. Everybody, I'm sure, knows this, but in case there's somebody who doesn't, you put your skins on the bottom of your skis, and you slide your skis up the hill. You kind of walk uphill. The pile of the skins, all not skins nowadays, but synthetic fur, holds you as you walk up. Anyway, I'd seen this slope, as I said, and a friend of mine and I were going to ski it, and then the day before, he got called away somewhere. And the next morning, before dawn, I opened the shutters of this little chalet I was staying in, and the sky was full of stars. And I thought, "Damn, I've got to go." So I got dressed, got my backpack, and got my skis, and drove as far as I could up the valley, and then started walking, and climbing on my skis. And I got up there as dawn broke about halfway up, and about a 3-hour climb to the top of this place. And as I reached the top, the sun was kissing the top of the slope, and I was so excited. It was like it was ecstasy, the sequins on the snow, the swooshy little half inch as it was transforming. And I took the skins off my skis, clicked the hinges down, and set off. And I put in perhaps two turns before I caught an edge and fell. And I fell, and I fell, and I fell, just catastrophically. I fell hundreds and hundreds of feet. I fell all the way down this slope. It was a really dumb thing to ski on your own. I mean, everybody knows you shouldn't go on your own when you go skiing in case of avalanches and anything that might happen. And I'd made that cardinal mistake. I knew, but I still wanted to do it. And I ended up, my skis came off, of course. I lost one pole. The other pole was bent like a horseshoe. And I ended up in this creek bed at the bottom of the mountain. And there were great holes with gushing water, white snowmelt water, rushing underneath. And if I'd gone into one of those, for sure, I wouldn't be here today. But I didn't. I landed in this fairly soft snow in between two of these holes. And I was lying there looking up at the sky, and I thought, well, it might be heaven. And it could be. But then I sat up, and I saw my skis were sort of down the river, both of them, amazingly, sort of had come down and were accessible. And I didn't seem to have broken anything. I was pretty badly bruised, as I discovered pretty soon after that. And as I stumbled back down the course of the river, down to where I'd left the car, I started to think about what would have happened if it had snowed that night, as indeed it did, and frozen hard. And in fact, that river was frozen, full of snow, and frozen for another couple of months. I'd have been there, frozen in the ice until somebody found me in the spring. And I realized I'd had a sort of story. This linked up with something else that I'd been obsessing about or thinking a lot about over the past few years, which was about long relationships breaking up. Looking around me, so many marriages, so many couples who'd got together early, like I did in my early 20s, seem to have broken up. And the people were left often, of course, hugely hurt. If there were kids involved, even more so. And often utterly bewildered, particularly the women,
if it was the guy who'd left, as generally it was, utterly bewildered about what had happened in many cases. It was like a car wreck. You know, just what happened to the guy? It just suddenly finished. And then it happened to me. A long marriage broke up, and I certainly didn't want to write my story, but I felt over the next few years, you know, over the last 7 years, I've learned so much about the way things are or can be between men and women who've been together for a long time. And when I fell into that creek, I realized I'd got the front story. I'd fallen into the front story. The divorce could be the backstory, the separation could be the backstory, but the front story could be this girl. I started to think who could be in the riverbed, and as Margaret told you, it turns out to be this daughter of Ben and Sarah Cooper. Her name is Abby. The title of the book refers to the place, this guest ranch in Montana, where they go year after year for their summer vacations, a kind of blissful place. And on the surface, at least, the Cooper family are a happy family. And then at this place, their marriage, the marriage of Ben and Sarah, starts to fracture, and this veneer of happiness starts to splinter. The two kids, Abby and Josh, Abby's about 18 when we first meet her. Well, actually, when we first meet her, she's in her early 20s, and we meet her dead. But when we first meet her in the flashback, she is the golden girl, the kind of girl that every parent would want. She's beautiful, she's popular, she's a good-natured, sweet-hearted person. Everybody adores her. She tries hard at school, she's top of everything, she's in the plays, the teams, all of this sort of stuff. And there she is at the beginning of this book, being chipped out of the ice by the police. And she's, when they're able to identify her, they discover that it's this girl who's wanted for murder and for acts of eco-terrorism. So on one level, the story is like a journey of discovery. What happened to this? How did this golden girl end up frozen in a block of ice in a creek bed in Montana? Of course, on another level, the divide refers, and this is the issue of the book, to what happens to men and women, the divide between men and women. One of the things that started to fascinate me was how it is that men and women can see the same set of circumstances when they get to their middle years in quite often very different ways. Now, this is to generalize horribly, and there may be those among you who will feel, hey, I'm on the other side of this divide, so forgive me for that. But I think generally this is more how it is than how it isn't. The women, when they've maybe got kids, they're off to... The kids are doing well at school, they're well launched. Women look at this time in their life with a sense of accomplishment and also a sense of optimism. They're maybe looking forward to having some more time on their own, to being a couple again, to being with their guy again, maybe find out what they liked about him in the first place if they've forgotten. And maybe they'll be able to do a bit of traveling, they'll have a little more money maybe when the kids are off their hands. The guy, meanwhile, often, and again, forgive the generalization, but sometimes the guy looks at this very same situation with something little short of horror. For him, it means, damn, I'm going to be an old guy. I'm going to be a grandfather maybe soon. His old age is looming, accelerating across the horizon towards him. And this is why I'm sure they sell so many red sports cars to men in their 40s. You know, they jump into the menopause and drive off after their lost youth, in search of their lost youth. I don't know if any of you have read a wonderful book by a guy called Robert Wright. It's called The Moral Animal. He's an evolutionary psychologist, and he looks at men, looks at human relations, in particular men and women relationships, through the lens of their evolutionary path. If you can look at something through a lens of a path, you probably can't, but anyway, looks at it through their evolution. Now, nowadays, most people seem to have adopted the Richard Dawkins selfish gene view that the human species, as indeed most species, if not all, the primary urge is to propel our genes as far into the future, well, propel our genes into the future, secure the gene line. Now, men and women, of course, do this in different ways according to, well, it's probably true, but Wright argues. Women, women have a very narrow band of opportunity as far as propelling their genes are concerned. You know, there's a big investment each time. 9 months is a long time. A man could have, you know, if he really put his mind to it, you know, many, many children in the space of, or sow the seed in many times in the space of 9 months. But a woman has all that invested in one child. So right from the start, a woman's perspective on the whole mating game is a much more sophisticated one. The decisions she has to take are far more subtle. You don't mate with a hunk, necessarily. He may look absolutely fantastic, you know, and everybody's after him, but he may not be the kind of guy who'll stick around long enough to protect you and the kids from the saber-toothed tigers, or bring the deer carcass to the cave door. So you maybe go for somebody who may be a little less hunky, but a little more nurturing, somebody who may stick around. He's got to be a little bit strong, because he's got to be a deer at the front gate, too. The man, on the other hand, you know, he can never be sure, so Wright argues, that the seed growing in the woman's womb, in his mate's womb, is his. There's always this question mark. You can never be sure. You don't know what she's doing when you're out hunting the caribou. So the precaution you take is to spread your genes as far and as wide as you possibly can, you know, and for as long as you can. You know, while you're on the walking frame, if you can still do it, it's worth doing, because you're sending those genes into the future. Now, these two, and otherwise the guy doesn't really have too much else to worry about. I mean, he has to be able to shoot straight, sharpen the spear, know where the deer are, you know how to protect himself, fight the guys over the hill. But these basic kind of primal animal roles, so Wright, I hasten to add again, so Wright argues, this is not me speaking, but even now, beneath the layer of sophistication and so-called civilization that we've put across our lives, contraception, equal opportunity at the workplace, these primal drives are at work. And women's, without a doubt, are much more complex. You know, you have to, if the woman is rearing, as generally was the case, less so now, but still often the case, if the woman is rearing the children, you have to understand human nature. You have to be much more kind of cognitive and instinctive and just know what's going on in human hearts and heads, whereas the guy doesn't have to know that so much. This, of course, is not, you know, this is not a biology book. It's not even a sort of self-help book. It's a story, and it's the story of the fragmentation of a marriage and the consequences that it has on each of them, and in particular on young Abby, this golden girl who steps across another divide. In the north of Wyoming, as many of you may know at the moment, there's a lot of drilling for coal bed methane going on with this new, there's a new technique. It costs much less than it used to cost. And one of the byproducts is this huge release of salt water. And a lot of that land up there, this beautiful land, particularly around Sheridan, where I have some good friends, whose land has been trashed by this drilling. There's very thin topsoil. They just move the topsoil. It just blows away. The salt water kills the cottonwoods and nothing will grow in the land. The fish die in the river. It's been a devastating impact. But everybody knows the reason for it. You know, there's a good, well, good, depending on your point of view, kind of purpose behind it, to make this country self-sufficient in fuel, or more self-sufficient in fuel. But Abby, when she sees what's happening to her boyfriend's folks in northern Wyoming, takes this fateful step across the divide between peaceful protest, and she's a kind of environmental, she's a demonstrator until that point, from peaceful law-abiding protest into serious kind of eco-terrorism. She joins the Earth Liberation Front, you don't have to join them, you just do it. And she does it. And she does it here in Denver, actually. I did two interviews on the TV today, and I forgot to say that the key moment in the story happens in Denver. The moment which kind of changes her whole life happens in Denver. The other part of the divide, just to go back to the men and women thing. When Ben goes to see his, he leaves Sarah, and a friend of mine phoned up the other night and said, I've just got to the point where he's leaving, and I've had to put it down and come outside. It's just so upset me. And he and this is a couple who've had quite hard times themselves. And he went back in and read it, and finished it off. Read it all through the night, and phoned me the next day. And in a very raw state, it had a profound effect on him. And a woman actually who'd been left by her husband a couple of years ago said to me after she read it, God, now I know what was going on in his head. I never knew. I had no idea. Anyway, when Ben leaves Sarah and he goes back to Kansas, where he grew up, to Abilene, and goes to visit his sister, expecting a kind of shoulder to cry on, he hasn't told her that he's left yet, but is expecting sympathy and comfort, and he gets none of this. Instead, he gets this absolutely scorching lecture from his sister, who says, what makes you so damn special? You know, we're all unhappy. What gives you the right to leave? And then she tells him that their mom and dad went through hard times, but they never thought of getting divorced. And it's true. My parents had hard times too. They never divorced. In fact, where I grew up in little countryside in England, my mom and dad's friends, among my mom and dad's friends, there was only one couple who was divorced, and there was something. Even as little kids, we knew they had a kind of aura of, well, naughtiness. Actually, for us kids, it was kind of exciting. We thought they were pretty cool people, but divorce was a rarity. Now in England, it's about 45% of marriages end in divorce. In here, in this country, it's like 60% now end in divorce. In fact, somebody in Minnesota the other day at an event said, "Yeah, they call them starter marriages now. The first one." Like a warranty on a TV set or something. You just, you know, do the starter marriage and then you know what to do next time. But Ben's sister gives him this great tirade about leaving and this right to happiness. What gives us the right to happiness? Where does this right come from? We do kind of think nowadays that we have a right to happiness. I studied law at college and... before I discovered, after about 10 minutes, that I didn't want to be a lawyer. But I was taught that any right has to have a corresponding duty. And I don't know what the duty is for the right to happiness, really. Maybe the duty to make other people happy. I don't know. But I think it's something, thinking about it and trying to write about it a little bit, it seems to me that it's... something that has resulted from the society that we've created for ourselves, this society where anything that isn't working, you check it in, you get a new one. You know, you buy the new car, the 500X, and in the next month, damn it, there's a 500XE, and I want it. You know, it's like the whole thing, the whole of Western capitalist society, if you like, is based on nurturing want. You're nurturing desire for material things, and I believe that this is fed through into personal relations. I think, you know, we're bombarded with images of celebrities, and, you know, there's, you know, Michael Douglas gets the new face and gets the new wife and all of the... Sorry, I don't know why I pick on him. He's a good guy. But you can trade anything in now. You can trade in your ears, your nose, your boobs, your car, your fridge, your tea, anything. You can get a new one of anything, a new pair of anything. And I think a lot of people now at a point where our mom and dad's generation would have said, okay, it's a hard time, but we're not going to get divorced. Now they say, yeah, we're going to go and get divorced now. I'm not going to do this. I've got a right to happiness. I'm going to make myself happy. I'm going to get a new one. And, you know, I'm not preaching anything in this book except just trying to shed a little light on people who sometimes feel confused when they've been through this. And I think if people really knew, particularly when there are kids involved, just when they open the lid on the divorce box, just how much hurt and pain was going to fly out of it and transform so many lives, you know, not just the immediate people, but friends who have to choose sides, grandparents who don't know what the hell to do. Maybe they don't get to see their grandchildren again. It's a really, really immense box of pain that's open. And I think if a lot of people knew just how much came out, they maybe wouldn't have, whatever you like to say, the foolishness or the courage or whatever to do it. Anyway, enough of a lecture. It's not a self-help book. It's a mystery story in one way. What we have to find out what happened to Abby, and we want to find out what happens to the Coopers. And it doesn't... I hope I haven't painted too bleak a picture of it. It'll probably make one or two people cry. I know it has already among those who've read it. But there is hope at the end of it, and a kind of resolution, and they each find their own set of tracks. In particular, the boy, Josh. I've told you a bit about Abby, but the teenage, just a final thing, the boy, Josh, who's 15 years old, he's always, whereas Abby's been the golden one, he's always been in her shadow a little bit. As a little kid, he was asthmatic, he was always sickly, his dad slammed his hand in the door, car door, when he was little, and he lost half a finger. Now he's 15, and we all know the type, you know, they're growing like an inch a day, and their hands are too... They're too big for their clothes. They don't know how to walk properly because, again, it's just new territory all the time. And he's been bullied at school, and now he's kind of hanging out with the wrong people, and he smokes too much pot. And Josh's story, the journey that Josh makes in this book, is the one that moves me most, because he becomes a man. And in a way, there's a big twist at the end of the story. In a way, he becomes the hero of the whole thing. As a writer, you get asked, you get lots of letters from people, and as a British writer whose books are American, I'm always really careful not to make mistakes when I'm writing about American culture. I feel I know enough about it. I've worked and lived for long periods in this country. But, so when I make a mistake, I feel really angry. After The Loop, I got about 20 letters from people who said, great, from America. Dear Mr. Evans, enjoyed the book, but on page 233, whatever it was, you have Buck Calder driving a red John Deere. Now, I know, you know, I've got one. They're all green. I'd actually taken a paragraph out earlier on in the kind of editing process, well, before I even handed the manuscript in, and I'd forgotten that it cropped up again, and I never spotted it. My publishers didn't spot it, because they live in New York, and they don't know what a tractor is, let alone what color they should be. But so it really, really annoyed me that I'd made this mistake. So I wrote back through gritted teeth, he painted it. You know, Bucket, Anyway, about 6 months ago, I got a letter from a woman in Wisconsin who said, "Dear Mr. Evans, about 4 years ago, I wrote you a letter about The Loop, complaining about the red John Deere. I have an apology to make." And she enclosed a picture of a 1932, I think it was 32, might have been 36, John Deere, red. And they, for a brief period in the 1930s, John Deere did make red tractors, and there was a picture of one. So I thought, yay, I got it right. Like, so you get lots of letters, too, from people, particularly young women, sort of late teens, who want to be writers, of writing short stories and just passionate about reading, and they want to be a writer. And quite often these letters say things like, "I've got this great idea for a bestseller, and how do I get an agent and a publisher?" And, you know, they haven't even written it yet. And so you have to gently write back and say, you know, I think probably you're on the wrong track here. The best thing you can do if you want to be a writer is read. And the next thing you want to do, because if you're already thinking about it being a bestseller, you're starting at the wrong end of the process. All you can do is find a story that moves you and tell it from the heart. And there's a chance then that it might move other people. But don't think about the reader. Just think about yourself. You know, please yourself. Excite yourself. Make yourself cry. You know, some days I sit there and my son will walk in. I have three grown-up kids and one little boy. And he walks into the office and I'm there sort of sobbing. He said, "Daddy, what's the matter?" It's all right. I'm just working. It's like, it's just work. So I write back in that way. I had a letter not so long ago from somebody who said, "Can anybody be a writer?" And the answer to that question is, sadly, no. You have to show early promise. And just to demonstrate this, I'd like to read to you, not from the book, but read to you my first published work. This was a poem that was published in the school magazine when I was 8 years old. And I think you, when you listen to it carefully, you'll be able to see the early promise here. It's called The Light. The sky was black as black could be. The stars were very bright. What did I see above that tree? Indeed, it was a light. It turned from blue to red, then green, then back to blue again. Could this really be a dream, or was I quite insane? The light came... It's good, isn't it? You with it? The tension, you know, the sort of internal... Is it my sanity? It's good. The light came nearer, nearer still. What could this object be? It passed across a woody hill. Its course was straight for me! Exclamation mark. I dodged beneath a tiny ledge. I trembled at the knee. The light, it landed by a hedge, very close to me. The light then gave a mighty bang. It shocked me with a jerk, for that which in my ears rang had been a firework. So, you see, you have to show early promise if you're going to be a writer. It absolutely amazes me that I ever dared put pen to paper again. But anyway, there it is. Now, I've talked far too long already, but I'd love to answer any questions, if anybody might have them. No, thank you. Yes, sir. I don't know how that happened, really. I mean, he was diabetic, and it's thankfully not a hugely common consequence of diabetes, but it happens. And I don't know, I just thought there was something very interesting about it. It raised a sort of trust issue. The book is really an old-fashioned story about loyalty and friendship. And Connor and Ed are best friends, and they both love the same woman, and Ed is married to her, and he's blind. And so it's a high test of friendship and loyalty, and it also just interested me. You know, there's very rarely a third-person omniscient narrator in my stories. I sometimes get a little close to it. I often cheat a bit, sort of start a chapter off with a piece that is almost... sort of objective, but I segue sneakily into somebody's head pretty soon. And I was interested in writing from inside the head of a blind person. It really interested me, and I did a lot of research and talked to a lot of people about it. And can you hear that at the back? I was asked why. I said on the website I rashly said that I thought The Divide was the best book that I'd written so far. And why did I say that? Have you read it yet? Okay, well, I won't ask you whether you do, but anyway. I think I've only written these four books, but each time it gets harder, and that's all self-inflicted. I just want to write better. When I wrote The Horse Whisperer, I'd just recently been let out of the jail of screenwriting, a greatly underrated art. You know, screenwriting is so damn difficult to write a good screenplay. You know, because you can't, you're not able to enter into your characters' hearts and heads. That you have to tell it like the camera, really. You tell character through action, unless it's a Woody Allen film, in which case everybody can tell everyone else how they're feeling the whole time. But which is the joy of it. But most screenwriting, most good, in my opinion, most good screenwriting tells character through action, which is why a lot of bad, you know, when you see a lot of door slamming and people, the sort of cliches of mood are so apparent in movies, and why the good movies avoid that. The great William Goldman, one of the greatest screenwriters ever, well, certainly wrote, in my view, the best book on screenwriting, or on Hollywood, certainly, Adventures in the Screen Trade, says that, you know, you write a good line of dialogue says exactly the has a character saying exactly the opposite, or often can have the character saying exactly the opposite of what we know he means. You know, so when somebody says "I love you," to be able to convey on screen that he damn well doesn't mean it is really it's a really hard thing to do. So I'd been writing screenplays for all this time, and I wrote The Horse Whisperer, my first novel, and it was like being let out of jail. To be able to jump into characters' heads and hearts and say how they feel and what they're thinking was just wonderfully exhilarating. Scary too, because there are no handrails. The rules of screenwriting, you know, are rails through the wilderness, and this is just wilderness novels. You can do anything. You can go anywhere. So I think I relished that a little bit too much. The easiest words in the world when you're writing a book are he felt and she felt. And to be able to, it's really nice to be able to tell people exactly how she felt and he felt, but to do it in a way that doesn't require you to use those words. I still use it occasionally through laziness more than anything. But to be able to do as somebody like Cormac McCarthy does, for example, in All the Pretty Horses, one of my all-time favorite books, to tell you how John Grady Cole, his hero, is feeling and thinking by the way the wind is sounding, or the way the sun, the way the skyline is looking, or the snuffle of a horse, or the call of a coyote. That's much more interesting, and that's what makes it more difficult, you know, as you try to do this. And I think with each book, I've gotten a little better at doing that, and telling a weaving a story together. And I think it's a very powerful book in many ways. The Horse Whisperer had its powerful moments, but there's a lot of raw stuff in here that people seem to have responded to. I live in Devon in the southwest of England, and the short answer to that is no, really, because why? You know, if you imagine, there's something about British contemporary life. I was going to say fiction, but fiction is a reflection of contemporary life, which is essentially small scale. It's like parochial. You can set a story in 17th, 18th, 12th, even 19th century Britain, and achieve pre-Second World War Britain, and achieve a kind of scale. But I don't think you can now. And I don't know, I kind of like to write big. I like the stories to have a bit of scale to them. And the second thing is that it's linked to the first one, is that still in Britain there is a kind of class... a lot of fiction is permeated by views on social class. You know, I don't believe it's true that America is free of social class, and I think it is true that Britain is much less infected by it than it was. It's a much more classless society than it was, Britain. And as a Brit, I find the whole British class scene endlessly fascinating, but it's really tedious when it gets in the way of the story. If you imagine The Horse Whisperer set in England, it illustrates both of these points, the scale of the story and its kind of class thing. If Annie Graves, some of you may not have read the a lot of you may not have read the book, if Annie Graves had a wounded horse and a daughter and wanted to take them to see the horse whisperer who lives, say, in Devon, which is kind of a long way away in British terms, she could leave after breakfast and get there by lunch and not have to fill up with gas. Now, in America, she sets off from New York State, and it's a week. It's like an epic drive with this wounded horse and wounded girl across America. So it's just that's a kind of obvious example. But the class thing, horse life in England is still very class-ish. And, you know, people who own horses tend to have the Range Rover and the green rubber boots and the headscarves like the Queen, you know, that sort of... And people who work with horses sort of tug their forelocks or their tweed caps to the Range Rover as it whooshes past and sprays them with mud. You know, that's the cliche. And I wanted these two characters in The Horse Whisperer to come from different social worlds, but neither one of them to feel essentially superior to the other. In fact, they probably both feel superior to each other in the American context. But it's a kind of equal. It's an equality there of status. The other thing that happens, and why I don't think I could write a story about set in Devon, is that you, as a screenwriter, you don't have a voice. You can write a sitcom, you can write a comedy, you can write a thriller, and they're different things each time. Although I write my stories through the eyes and through the heart of each of various characters, of the key characters, I still am aware that I have a voice. And with the writing of The Horse Whisperer, that voice was born, and whether I like it or not, and I do actually, it's a more poetic kind of, that sounds terribly pretentious, I don't mean that. Maybe because I'm a foreigner to this country, it's like verse in a way for me to write American. And one or two people have said that about The Horse Whisperer in particular, that there's a kind of I don't even go further on this because it sounds so kind of soody. But that's why I couldn't kind of jettison that voice and write something else. I like the voice. I love being an outsider in this culture and seeing things that I perhaps would take for granted if I had been born and grown up here. Sorry, long answer, short question. Yes, sir. I spent time with three people in particular. Yeah, I started off in New... I'd kind of set it all this trip up. I was here in the West for about 6 weeks. I started off in New Mexico, where I went to see a guy called Ray Hunt, who now lives, as I understand, in Idaho. I think he's been not too well lately, but... they moved up to Idaho, but they were in New Mexico, just east of Santa Fe. Then I went to see Tom Dorrance, who had taught Ray, and Tom was one of, I think, seven brothers. Bill Dorrance was the only other one alive when I met Tom, who was then about 85, and Tom Dorrance was kind of the king of them. He lived in a trailer. He did it all for the horse. He never made any money out of his work at all. He loved this animal and did it for the horse. So Tom taught Ray, and Ray taught Buck Brannaman, a younger guy, probably about in his middle 40s now, I guess. And Buck lives in Sheridan, Wyoming, and he's a good friend now. And he did all the work on the movie, did the horse work on the movie. Another person who I met for about an hour and never saw him work with a horse was Monty Roberts. And I knew within a few moments of meeting him that this was not a model for my character. However, I understand it has been widely put about that he was the model for the character, and it just isn't true. And I saw other people too. I mean, there was a woman who used to work with Buck called Leslie Desmond, who now is based in Scandinavia, who I learned a lot from too. Hey, well, thank you all so much for coming tonight. One more, yeah. Almost peace. Well, almost peace. If you read it, you'll get that. Thank you so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Walter Kern, Nicholas Sparks, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 10th, 2005.